And now we're going to continue our studies in the book of Ruth. We did the first three chapters, and then we had a break of 2 weeks while other things happened. And now it's time to finish off this marvellous little book. And we're on to Ruth chapter 4. And the passage that we're going to be studying is pages 269 and 270. But let me just recap a little bit of the story so that we know where we're up to. If you've been with us or you've read the book recently, then you'll no doubt remember that Ruth and her mother-in-law, Naomi, have returned as destitute widows from the foreign land of Moab, of which Ruth was a native, to the ancestral hometown of Bethlehem in Judah. And there, they have fallen upon a stroke of, quotes, luck. We all know what kind of luck that was, don't we? When Ruth went out to gather grain, to glean the leftovers from a field, it so happened that she went to the field of Boaz. Boaz was a relative of the family who had a duty of care to these returned widows. But of course, an act of initiative was required to get something to actually happen. And so, on the advice of Naomi, Ruth had snuck into the threshing floor at the end of the harvest and had gone as far as creeping in to Boaz's own bed in order to invite him to live up to his responsibilities as her kinsman redeemer. And we left the story hanging in verse 18. Boaz has sent Ruth back again, back home, but there is some unfinished business. And so in verse 18, we're waiting to see what happens. Then Naomi said, verse chapter 3, Naomi said, "Wait, my daughter, until you find out what happens, for the man will not rest until the matter is settled today." And we're going to conclude the story. But rather than invite you to read it along with me right now, I'm going to ask you to do something different. Keep it open, because we'll refer back to it in a little while. But I want you to imagine, and I'm going to tell the story from a slightly different perspective. I want you to imagine a little low-lying flat-roofed house in a village called Bethlehem on a warm summer's evening. There's a golden rosy glow shining through a little window in the side of the house. And there, in the bed, is a little figure curled up under the covers. As we watch, the door crashes open. "Grandma! Grandma, it's me!" And the old lady in the bed wakes up with a start from her sleep. "Why, you scamp," she says to the little boy as he stood in the doorway of her room, lit up by that sun through the window. "You've given me the fright of my life." But she was smiling as she said it. The years had creased her face and clouded her eyes, but you could still detect a faint foreign accent in her voice, even after all this time in Bethlehem. "I suppose it's a story you're after," she says. "Hop up here then." The little boy climbs onto the bed and nestled into the blankets. "Now then, where did I get to last time?" "It was the bit where you crept into Grandad's bed at night," says the little boy. "Oh yes, that," she says. "I remember. The most exciting time of my life. And the scariest, I can tell you." And as she tells the story, her ancient body seems to get a fresh burst of life, remembering those amazing days. "None of my friends ever did anything so brave or so silly. But I had to find a way to get him to marry me. I was so relieved when he said yes, I can tell you. But it still wasn't over." "What happened?" the boy asked, wide-eyed. "Well," she said, "there was another man. I didn't know him at all. I'd never met him. But he was a closer relative to my old husband than Grandad. That meant he had the right to marry me. He had the right to restore our land. He was the nearest kinsman redeemer, you see. And my heart sank when I heard about him. But your granddad found a way to sort that one out. You see, the very next morning, he went up to the city gate and he sat down there. That's the normal place to do business. Watch out, next time you go there, you'll see them all sitting around. When the kinsman redeemer he had mentioned came along, Grandad said to him, "Come over here, my friend, and sit down." So he did. Now, Grandad needed some legal witnesses. So he got 10 of the old town elders, and he got them to come and sit down as well. And then he said to the kinsman redeemer, "Naomi, who has come back from Moab, is selling a piece of land that belonged to our brother, Elimelech." "Hang on," said the boy, butting in. "I thought you were dead poor when you came back to Israel." "That's right," replied the old lady. Naomi didn't exactly have the land in her possession. It had already been sold or lost to someone else. But she had the right to buy it back, you see. Under Israel's law, God gives each family the right to our own land permanently. Nobody can ever take it away from us forever. So Naomi wasn't selling the land as such. She was selling the right to redeem it. The money would actually go to the people who were using it at the time. Anyway, listen to the story. Grandad played it cool. He said to the other man, "I thought I should point out to you that Naomi is selling this land and suggest that you buy it in the presence of these elders sitting here. If you will redeem it, do so. But if not, if you won't, well, tell me, so I will know. No one else has the right to do it except you, and you are next in line." I will redeem it," said the man. Gulp, thought Grandad, but he didn't let on. He said, "On the day you buy the land from Naomi and from Ruth the Moabitess, you acquire the dead man's widow as well, so as to maintain the name of the dead with his property." Now, Grandad told me he was actually really nervous at this point. What if the man said yes? But Grandad had worked it out right. Not that I particularly liked being a free gift along with the land, mind you. The other man, he wouldn't mind buying the land back. Since Naomi has no sons, he would have got it himself anyway. But to marry me as well? Now that was a different kettle of fish. He would have had to pay for the land, and then look after me. And then, if I'd have had a son, the land would have stayed in our family and not gone into his, and he would have lost out. Grandad said he could almost see the cogs turning in the other man's head as he did the sums. This could cost him a lot. And so the other man said, "Then I cannot redeem it, because I might endanger my own estate. You redeem it yourself. I cannot do it." Now, in those days, to make a deal final, one person would take off his shoe and give it to the other. Sounds strange, I know, but that's the way of legalising the sale in those days. So the other kinsman redeemer said to Grandad, "Buy it yourself." And he removed his sandal and gave it to him. Grandad used to say he was so relieved he nearly kissed it, but he didn't. Instead, he made a little speech to the elders and all the people. "Today you are witnesses that I have bought from Naomi all the property of Elimelech and Kilian and Mahlon. I have also acquired Ruth, the Moabitess, Mahlon's widow, as my wife, in order to maintain the name of the dead with his property, so that his name will not disappear from among his family or from the town records. Today you are witnesses." And then all the elders and everyone at the gate said, "We are witnesses." And everybody cheered and blessed us. They all knew our story by now, of course, how we'd come back from Moab with absolutely nothing, and how I'd decided to trust the Lord, the God of Israel, even though I was a foreigner. And I still remember to this day the blessing that they gave to us. "May the Lord make your wife like Rachel and Leah, who together built the house of Israel. May you have standing in Ephratah and be famous in Bethlehem. Through the offspring the Lord gives you by this young woman, may your family be like that of Perez, who Tamar bore to Judah, the father of our tribe." The old lady seemed to get lost in thought at this point, but the boy was bursting with questions, and he didn't let her rest for long. "I don't understand," he said. "What's a kinsman redeemer? A kinsman redeemer is a relative who looks after you when you fall on hard times, she replied. God has given us a wonderful land, and if we're obedient to him, life is normally good. But often we're not obedient, and even when we are, even then, sometimes things still go wrong. So God made these laws about kinsmen redeemers, you see. Say you'd had to sell your family land. Well, the redeemer's job was to come along and buy it back for you. Say you were a victim of a crime. Well, the redeemer's job would be to try and make sure that justice was done on your behalf. Or say you had such bad debts that you yourself got sold into slavery. And that can happen, you know. Well, the redeemer should come along and pay off your debts to set you free from being a slave. And if a woman's husband died without having a son, the redeemer might even marry the widow to look after her and to provide a son to carry on the dead man's family name. That's very important, you know. If you're a woman, then you're useless if you can't have a son. Or so the men tell us anyway. So was it really awful of that other man not to be your redeemer? Said the boy. Oh, I'm glad he didn't. Who'd want to marry that old skinflint? She replied. Can't imagine him changing nappies, can you? But actually, he didn't really do anything wrong. The law only said he had to marry me if he was my husband's brother. He wasn't a bad man. But he didn't want to do anything more than mere duty required. He was a bit like my sister-in-law, Orpah, I suppose. Remember how she offered to leave Moab with us, but she didn't really insist when she had the chance to get out of it? She didn't really want to do it so much she was willing to pay a price. But Grandad did do it, didn't he? Said the boy proudly. Oh, yes. Grandad was a fine man. He didn't have to. It cost him a lot of money to redeem the land. And everyone said it was a big risk to marry a foreign woman whose first husband had died and who didn't have any children. That was not a good sign. I might have been blighted. I might not have been fertile. Perhaps I never would have children of my own. But Grandad was a special kind of man. You see, he loved me with all his strength and all his heart, not just because it was a duty. And he did as much as he could for me, not merely as much as he should for me. A redeemer who saves you because the law says he must is nothing like as good as a redeemer who saves you because love says he must. That's the reason that God keeps on saving us. You know, there's no law that says God has to be merciful. We've done far too many things to expect him to be kind to us. But God does it because he loves us, not because he has to. So I suppose Grandad's love for me was a bit like God's love for all of us. A faithful love, a sacrificial love, willing to pay a price. A love that would last you the rest of your life and forever. Wow, said the boy. Wow indeed, said Grandma Ruth. And when you know that you are loved in that special way, it's worth 100 times all the laws and rights in the world. They help to stop things getting worse. But God's redeeming love changes things. God's love actually makes things better. I remember another day, about a year later, we'd got married and the Lord had enabled me to have a baby. Having babies is not fun, I can tell you, but I forgot it, forgot all about the pain as soon as I held that little boy in my arms the first time. I'd have had another straight away if I could. I have heard women say that. I remember the look on my mother-in-law's face too. All the women were crowding round. "Praise be to the Lord," they said, "who this day has not left you without a kinsman redeemer. May he become famous throughout Israel. He will renew your life and sustain you in your old age. For you, for your daughter-in-law, who loves you and who is better to you than seven sons, has given him birth." And then Naomi took the baby, laid him on her lap, and cared for him. And all the women said, "Naomi has a son. I have never seen happiness like it." And by now, Ruth's dark cheeks were glistening with tears as she remembered the scene, more vivid and more colourful than if it was yesterday. And to think how she'd been only a year before, so utterly wretched and in despair, she said, all day just looking out of the window, hardly ever speaking, and when she did, only pouring out her bitterness. "The Lord has made me empty," she used to say every day. "When I saw her with my baby, her Redeemer, in her arms, I realized what a miracle God can do. The other man, well, if I'd married him, I'm sure he'd have done his best. But that would only have filled an empty larder. But God's love, through Boaz, had filled an empty heart." The boy sat up in his nest in the old lady's bed. A thought had struck him, and he looked out for a while at the lights of the town around them, Bethlehem twinkling in the dark. "How wonderful it must be to rescue people," he said, "especially when their hearts are empty. I wonder if I will ever be a kinsman redeemer for the people that I love." Grandma smiled. "Oh yes, little David," she said. "I think you probably will." Well, we don't know whether the young David and Ruth actually did meet. She was, in fact, his great-grandmother, not his grandmother. If you look at the end of the chapter you should have open in front of you, we see that in verse 17. "The women living there said, 'Naomi has a son,' and they named him Obed. And he was the father of Jesse, the father of David." So it's quite conceivable David did meet his great-grandmother, Ruth. But, of course, he was the eighth son of Jesse, and so Ruth would have had to be very ancient and David really quite young for this meeting to have happened. Nonetheless, it's a thought that I like to entertain. David knew a lot about love, didn't he? A lot about faithfulness. A lot about redeeming lost situations. And maybe David did learn his first lessons about God's chesed. Remember that word? God's faithful covenant love. From the women who 60 years before had left a faraway country with her mother-in-law and had come to experience it herself so profoundly and so deeply. And the author of the book certainly wants to make that link, doesn't he? A link between David and Ruth. The story ends in a peculiar way. Most storytellers would finish at verse 17, wouldn't they? That's a nice sort of a neat conclusion. But this book carries on a bit, and it ends with a genealogy. Genealogies are things in the Bible that we all think are very boring, but in actual fact are very important, not just in the ancient world, but also in many, many cultures around the world today. We see that genealogy in verses 18 to 22. I had to read this in King's College Chapel once, where you mustn't make any mistakes at all. And there's some quite hard words there, not as hard as the ones I gave John earlier on in the service today. Let's read verse 18 to 22. "This then is the family line of Perez. Perez was the father of Hezron. Hezron the father of Ram. Ram the father of Amminadab. Amminadab the father of Nahshon. Nahshon the father of Salmon. Salmon, the father of Boaz. Boaz, the father of Obed. Obed, the father of Jesse. And Jesse, the father of David." Now, it seems a rather laboured way to finish a story, doesn't it? Doesn't really leave you flushed with excitement, and nor is it easy on the tongue. Why do you think it's there? Why do you think it's emphasised quite so much? At primary school, we had two little exercise books to write in our English lessons. In one of those exercise books, spaceships would land in our garden. Smugglers would stash contraband in the school bike sheds and we'd find it. And I scored last-minute hat-tricks for England in the World Cup final. It was a good book. In the other one, there was a washing machine that flooded the living room carpet. The guinea pig died. And Granny taught us how to do forward rolls. She was one cool Granny. One book, you see, was for the stories, for our imagination to run riot. The other book was for the news. The other book was for the things that really happened in our lives that week. And no prizes for guessing which book was which. And that so often is what life seems like, doesn't it? There's stories and there's the reality. There are some connections between the two. The reality controls the stories a bit, doesn't it? Because good stories have to touch base somewhere, even if they're total fantasy. The characters have to be realistic and so on. And of course, stories can have effect on reality too. A little bit, anyway. A good story can inspire us, or comfort us, or challenge us a bit, give us an insight into things. But that's all, really, isn't it? They can have just a sort of limited effect in the mind of the reader. Sometimes you need more than good stories, don't you? Sometimes you need actual objective reality, things that you know are real and true. Leave this book at the end of the story, and all you've got is a book that just basically could be any old story anywhere. It's heartwarming, it's morally inspiring, it's a true account of the past, even. But how does even a true account of the past help ancient Israelites living centuries later when the book is written down? Their country is racked with corruption, it's split with division, it's threatened by invasion, they're rotting in exile. And the people of Israel say, fine, but we need more than just nice stories. We need more than having our hearts warmed and a bit inspired and comforted. We need rescuing. We need saving. We need redeeming. Where is the faithful covenant love of God here and now? Where is God with us? Good stories aren't enough in a crisis like this. We need good news right now. And so this little list of names at the end of the book, this genealogy says, here is the good news. The good news is with you. His name is David, and his sons who rule in his name, God's king. They are the present, tangible means of God's covenant love to his people through all generations. They are what tells you that this isn't just story, this is news. Israel has a kinsman redeemer who does for it what Boaz did for Naomi or Ruth. Or should I say, what Ruth and Obed did for Naomi. Did you notice that in verses 14 and 15? Let's just read those again. The women said to Naomi, praise to the Lord, who this day has not left you without a kinsman redeemer. May he become famous throughout Israel. He will renew your life and sustain you in your old age. For your daughter-in-law, who loves you and who is better to you than seven sons, has given him birth. That's amazing, isn't it? It's not your daughter-in-law has married him, Boaz. It's given him birth. It's this little baby who's redeeming Naomi's life. And it says, Israel, David, or the one who comes from David, can do for you what this little baby Obed did for Naomi. Israel, Ruth's story belongs in your news book as well as in your story book. And this prospect of one to come from the line of David is reality, not fantasy. Israel, you too can be redeemed by the Lord. That's what it says to the ancient people for whom this was written. What about us? Because for us, from our perspective, there is a question mark still hanging over this story. And it's the same question mark that hangs over every Old Testament story. A good storyteller can always write the story with a neat conclusion, can't they? Even if they're telling a true story. But real life and history is just not like that. When you're living through it, you don't find a sort of neat beginning, middle, and then a happy ending, do you? What it's actually like in real life, is a sequence of messy and confusing episodes. And there are plenty of moments of light relief along the way, but you never come to that point where you think, there's the happy ending, full stop. Not in our news book, anyway. The Old Testament, in some ways, is a bit unrealistic, because it only ever manages to get to the happy ending by stopping before the real ending. What happens if we carry this story on? Well, Ruth gave birth to Obed, and then she grew old and died. Obed was the father of Jesse, and then they both grew old and died. Jesse was the father of David, and he, well, grew old and died. And so the story goes on and on and on, doesn't it, in Israel's history? The whole unresolved question hangs over the hope that the Old Testament offers. Even when God steps in to redeem the situation, in the end it seems temporary. All the Moses and the Davids and all the other people like that could only ever do so much. And when you read them, they are stories there and then, not here and now, because Moses and David and people like that are not with us here and now. And that question hangs in the air all the way through the Old Testament. And then you get to Matthew chapter 1. There, at the very start of it, Matthew, as we'll see next week, takes this little list of names and he carries it on. And he finishes with Jesus. And Matthew, at last, has got the privilege of turning a great story into real good news. Good news that doesn't just inspire us and comfort us and inform us. Good news that isn't just a helpful way, a helpful perspective to enable us to deal with life. Good news that actually, really saves us, rescues us, redeems us from the mess we're in. And Jesus does not belong in the book with spaceships and smugglers and Roy of the Rovers. Jesus belongs in the book with the broken washing machine and the dead guinea pig and the cool somersaulting grandma. Jesus belongs in the book with the real issues that affect us every day of our lives. Jesus belongs with the red final demands and the redundancy notices, with the broken hearts and the failed exams, with the poverty and the war and the sickness and the death. Jesus belongs there with the real news, where the pain really hurts, where the chains are real, whether they're made of steel or of sin, where there are whips and thorns and nails that can even make him bleed. I once worked with somebody who was herself very heavily in debt at the time, and it wasn't really her fault. She was a single mum, and through no fault of her own, some money that she was entitled to from the particular source was not being paid. Nobody seemed interested in helping her actually get this money she was owed. Social services said that it was not their business. They were going to stop all her benefits because she was entitled to this money, whether or not she was actually getting it. They were going to cut everything off. The council said that it was not their business that she wasn't actually getting this money. She was entitled to it. And so they were going to evict her and her little daughter from her flat for the rent arrears that she owed. Her family would have liked to help, but they were in no position to do so. And she was completely at the end of her tether. She just didn't know which way to turn or what to do. And you could see the stress that these debts were writing on her face. The crushing burden of anxiety. The sadness at what this situation was doing to her daughter. The sense of failure. How I have let my daughter down. The lack of sleep, the fear in her life. She used to hide in the back room every time the doorbell went, in case it was the bailiffs serving the eviction notice on her. And she knew that one day they'd catch her. They'd be waiting on the doorstep when she came back from the school with her little daughter, something like that. And then suddenly, it was over. This long, dragged-out nightmare was gone. What happened? Well, she'd been to her doctor, because she was feeling so depressed she thought she couldn't cope. And her doctor had taken up the case. And he happened to know the right people to shout at in this particular situation. And the check was on her doorstep in 3 days' time. Can happen. And it was amazing. When that debt was lifted from her, she seemed to grow 6 inches in height. She seemed to lose several years of age overnight because she was free. The debt was paid. Or you could say she had been redeemed from her situation. Well, whether we know it or not, we, by rights, have a debt that is real. A debt that is our fault, not someone else's. A debt that is far greater than we could ever pay. Our debt is moral, not material. Our debt weighs on our conscience and our hearts, as well as upon our pockets. Our debt curses others around us. Our debt is owed to God. Our debt cannot be escaped or avoided, not even by dying, let alone hiding in the back room. Our debt cannot be blamed upon the injustice or inadequacy of others. Our debt will always catch us up and drag us down to hell. That is the burden we live under. Unless, that is, our debt has been paid by our Redeemer. And it takes a lot more than being shouted at by a doctor to get that done. Our Redeemer had to die to pay the price of our sins. But paid it is. It's news, not stories. And that's where this little story of Ruth must get us to. To Christ, our Redeemer, who buys us back from the mess of our world and of our sins. Of course, we found it's full of lots of other things too. Practical lessons about bereavement, about courtship, about taking initiatives, about faithfulness and love. But in the end, its purpose is to point us to the great Redeemer who buys us back from the pit of our sins. David's greater son, the root of Jesse, Jesus Christ. And if the story of Jesus is written into your news book as well as your storybook, and if the truth of his life can be seen in the words of every page, well, you too can grow 6 inches and shed a few years, because it's redemption day for you.